extra, extra real.
The Last of the Titans. The Last of the Titans. The Last of the Titans.
Extra, extra,
extra, extra,
extra, extra, extra, extra, read all about it. Extra, 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 read all about it. Extra.
Hello, fans. Welcome to Titans Extra. Today, Kelly Nelson here, and today I am joined by the one, the only, Marty Sleaze.
Marty,
I'm doing very well, coming to you live from Titletown, USA. Let's go Patriots tonight. We're filming right before the Super Bowl.
Yes, Super Bowl Sunday.
And we're working hard, wrestling and football, nothing better than that.
Yes, that's a great combination. Squeezing this in before the Super Bowl later today. Today, we are looking at something that's, you know, kind of unusual, I would say, for a Titans show, in that, you know, we usually focus on the 70s, the early 80s, sort of the more, you know, obscure stuff, the pre-Hulkamania years. But today, we are sort of nudging into that era. We're starting with 1985.
Only 30 years old.
Yes, 30 years ago. Oh my God, I've almost been a wrestling fan for 30 years. It's pretty crazy to think about that. And specifically, we're looking at something that, you know, it's a well traveled aspect of pro wrestling. A lot of people have discussed this, but being Titans, you'll get the special, unique Titans slant on things. A little more in depth, you know, not to knock anyone out there. But hey, you know, Titans of wrestling means quality, means knowledgeable opinions.
Means watching the footage and going to the primary sources and not just going based on hearsay.
That's right. You won't have any hearsay on Titans of Wrestling. Nothing but obsessive footage watching from us. We are looking at the WWF tag team wrestling scene, and basically from the 1980s. Who knows? I mean, I envision this as being sort of the first of a ongoing, you know, periodic look at the WWF tag team scene, starting in 1985 and going forward till, I think, I guess, Marty, we get sick of it, basically.
90s Demolition, probably 91, Nasty Boys is when I'd probably end it.
Yeah, I think that's a good call, too. When things start to, when you get a lot of, like, makeshift tag teams all of a sudden, is that's sort of when the writing is on the wall, that the golden years are over. But, you know, this era is looked back fondly by fans of the WWF as like basically, you know, one of the golden ages of WWF tag team wrestling. For a lot of people, the golden age of WWF tag team wrestling. And, you know, first, before we get into it, you know, just to explain why 1985, like, why are we just choosing this year? For me, 1985, you see the debut of a few teams that would come to define the era, like the British Bulldogs, the Hart Foundation. The division started to become more defined, I would think, around this time. You know, prior to 1985, you had, of course, you had tag team wrestling for years and years, but from 1985 forward, you got the sense that it was more of its own universe. It became a deeper division than it was, you know, in the early 80s. With a lot more tag teams. And if you look at, say, 1984, for example, that still feels like the Vince Senior sort of years of the WWF, where at the beginning you had, you know, Tony Atlas and Rocky Johnson as the tag team champions. Dick Murdoch and Adrian Adonis win the tag belts and hold them for most of 1984. And they feel more like a Vince Senior team, I would say, than a Vince Jr. team. And the Samoans were still around in 1984. Yeah. So that's definitely a team with huge ties to the past, to the pre 85 years. And also in 1985, the classic tag team straps make their first appearance at some point, I think about the summer of 1985.
Okay.
Yeah, the ones that, for me anyway, when I first became a fan, that was the belts they used. And they would use them for, gosh, well into the 90s. Right now I'm blanking on when they actually changed the belts. I guess it was like around 98, was it?
I don't know. I'm actually not a belt mark, so I don't know much. I don't know much about belts. I just know the major ones. I don't know the tag team belts.
Well, because I got into wrestling around this time, I have a total, you know, romantic attachment to the belts that they had at that time, and they did last for quite a while. Like the Intercontinental title lasted for quite a while with that.
Well, that one's classic. I know that one off the top of my head. I should think of the tag team title right now.
Yeah. So I think it was a good, you know, dozen years that they had this classic look that debuted in the summer of 85. So that's another sort of symbol, I think, of the golden age or the era we're going to look at. So Marty, one of the reasons that I put together this show with you was because, you know, a few years ago at Pro Wrestling Only, the message board we all hang out at, you wrote quite a few reviews of matches from this era, and that's where I stood up and took notice of you for the first time, I'll admit, and that sort of was like the reason I recruited you into the fold was because I really liked your take on wrestling and specifically the take on the 80s tag teams. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, well, I appreciate the compliment. Yeah, it was probably the first big project that I undertook at Pro Wrestling Only, and for whatever reason, the Islanders Strike Force feud, which right. I think we'll get to on later episodes, is what caused me to become noticed on Pro Wrestling Only. Mm-hmm. The reason I chose 80s tag team wrestling was because of the praise that the Hart Foundation got, the British Bulldogs, and how, you know, the WWF tag team scene in the late 80s was so good. And some people would even say it was better than the NWA late 80s tag team scene. I don't agree. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't say for sure unless I watched it myself. And then I watched it, and there's some good stuff, there's some bad stuff, there's some overrated stuff, there's some underrated stuff. As in everything, mm-hmm. The truth lies somewhere in between.
Yeah. No, I mean, you looking at that feud, the Islanders and Strikeforce, was unique. Because, usually you'll hear about the Hart Foundation, the Bulldogs, as sort of the main teams of the era. And for whatever reason, you know, Strikeforce and the Islanders are kind of under the radar a bit as far as, you know, the teams you would rattle off the top of your head as being part of that era. And, yeah, they produced awesome matches together.
So I was glad to shine the spotlight, especially on Tama, the other Islander not named Haku,
right.
Who I think could have been actually a main event level heel. He was that good.
Yeah, he was very talented.
Yeah.
And we'll eventually be getting to that period, and I'm looking forward to going over that because there's stuff that I haven't seen from that era that I know is praised quite highly that I really look forward getting into. For myself, you know, I got into wrestling in 1986, right after WrestleMania 2, or sort of when WrestleMania 2 was happening. I remember The Build and Mr. T being involved, and I've told the story a million times. But anyway, I immediately embraced like tag team wrestling as my favorite part of the show, basically. Specifically, of course, the Bulldogs. I really got into them. They were the tag champs at that time. They wrestled, you know, in a different style than most. You know, they were fast. They were, you know,
they were definitely offensive. Like when I went back and watched them, they're all about offense.
Yeah, and when you're a kid, that was just amazing. You know, I go back and look at matches now, and I'd rather have, you know, like a Dick Murdoch, Adrian Adonis type match. But then, you know, it was all action, and especially the Dynamite Kid. I just loved Dynamite, and unfortunately, like I just caught the tail end of it all because, you know, a few months into my wrestling fandom, Dynamite was injured in a match in Hamilton. His back went out, and that was essentially, you know, they would still team for a few more
right.
years, but that was about the end of it for the Bulldogs, and they dropped the straps not too long after. But from that point forward, I still was big into the tag teams. Strikeforce, you know, Tito was basically my favorite singles wrestler, or one of them. and having
you have
him,
great taste.
Yes,
Kid Kelly had great taste.
As an 8-9-year-old, I had exquisite taste. I was into Tito Santana before anybody else. You know, I got it almost 30 years before he was discovered as being a great worker. I knew that as a 9-year-old. So when he formed a team with Rick Martel, who I also really liked at the time, I was big into that style of fiery babyface. Martel, Steamboat too, of course. I really liked those guys more than the real big names like Hogan. Even as a kid, I could, you know, take it or leave it with him a lot of the time. I liked the more intercontinental level guys. And so the having Strikeforce together was cool. And then winning the titles was great, because even as a kid, I kind of sensed that Tito was on the downswing of his career, and I was kind of surprised that he had this last run in him with a strap, and that was really cool. I can still remember the day that match aired on TV on Saturday watching it, and it was a highlight when they beat the Hart Foundation. And so, yeah, I continued to be a big tag fan. I was a big fan of the Rockers.
They're awesome. Yeah. They're actually underrated.
Yes. I think so. I think they may actually be the best team of the era. When
I think so by far.
Yeah. When it all said and done. And I was able to watch AWA in Canada on TSN, so I was aware of them already as the Midnight Rockers. And yeah, I that carried over completely into when they came to the WWF, so I was a big fan of them. So yeah, like as I said, as a kid, I was just a huge fan of tag wrestling, so...
Well, I mean, tag wrestling's great because there's more moving parts. You have more moving pieces. You have four rather than two.
Exactly. It's more exciting. When it's done right, tag wrestling is maybe the best wrestling there is.
I really think so. I mean, not to branch off into Japanese wrestling or anything, but when people talk about the great All Japan matches, it's actually the tag team matches that are usually, like, you know, that are in the top five or so.
Oh, totally. And I think later in the show we may dabble or get into a bit of, you know, just Japan tag wrestling, at least as like a comparison point to a WWF. The 80s as a whole was kind of, you know, when you look at the territories and internationally, was tag wrestling was kind of thriving all over the place, in the United States, Canada, and globally. And it would kind of be the end of an era in a lot of ways, as you move forward into the 90s and then all the way to the present, where the focus on tag wrestling has never been the same again. Would you agree with that, Marty?
Yeah, I agree that, the focus, even in Japan in the 2000s, tag wrestling has been de-emphasized, which is a shame.
Yeah, it's, and we'll get into that too later, because there's a lot to talk about, I think, with, as far as like Vince Jr. is concerned and his sort of philosophy on wrestling or philosophy on tag wrestling. I mean, something you hear a lot about. Traditionally, just before we get into 1985, I just want to give a little context maybe for WWF, WWWF, and even further back, Capital Wrestling, the original McMahon family promotion, and look sort of at the history of tag team wrestling as it goes through the years. I mean, the WWF, WWE now has a very long history with tag team wrestling. With some big important eras, not just the 80s, the first golden age, and maybe if you look at it from like a perspective of headlining main events and making money and drawing big houses, maybe the real true golden age of McMahon family tag team wrestling was the late 50s, early 60s, when you had, you know, Argentina Rocca, a huge star in New York, and his team with Miguel Perez. They main evented, if you look at the results, from about 1957-58 to about 62, more often than not, the majority of the main events at least Madison Square Garden were tag team matches.
Wow.
It became a huge thing, and it was similar in other parts of the United States around that time. Tag wrestling really took off for whatever reason. It was after the big boom of the early 50s, and I think maybe this was sort of like something new when people kind of got burned out on wrestling, that the promoters kind of went with tag wrestling as like a new attraction. And it really took off, not just in the Northeast, but it took off big in the South. And it would stay big in the South going forward, to the point where certain promotions like Memphis and the Crockett, JCP, in the Carolinas became known as tag team territories, where their main events were always tag team matches, and their main feuds were based on tag team feuds. And the AWA in the Midwest became a big tag team territory. In New York, it was hot, really hot in the late 50s and early 60s. And then the next transition was from Rocca to Sammartino, and Sammartino being pushed as a big singles star as the world champion, or the, yeah, well, sometimes world champion, sometimes just WWF champion. It's a point of contention. And that became the focus from about 63 forward, and you saw sort of the tags getting phased down. But there, if you look at the cards, still throughout the 60s, like tag wrestling still was featured heavily and into the 70s. Some of the names associated in the late 50s, early 60s with tag wrestling in New York are the original Graham brothers, Golden Graham's tag team, Dr. Jerry Graham and Eddie Graham. A team I'd love to see footage of. That's one of the things about, you know, this era, is there's not a lot of footage, unfortunately.
Yeah,
by the late 50s, early 60s, you start to get into that dark era that you kind of just have the legend of these things and black and white photos and stuff, but you don't have a lot to actually analyze as far as footage goes. But some huge names, the Fabulous Kangaroos tag team, which is often cited as maybe the best tag team of all time, was big at this time. The Fargo brothers, the Tolos brothers, a lot of brothers tag teams. Mark Lewin and Don Curtis were a famous team too, like babyface hunks from the time. Yeah. And so, and the main titles were the United States tag team titles at this time. And there was a lot of United States tag team titles throughout the United States at that time. Various different territories had their own versions of it. Marty, are you familiar at all with this era?
I mean, I know the names, but I don't know too much. Like, I know Mark Lewin's name, but I always associate him as a heel in Florida.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah. That's true. If you only know him as like Purple Haze in Florida, you'd be shocked. But he started very young. Like, he was a wrestling prodigy, I think, from like still a teenager.
Well.
Yeah. And the Lewin and Curtis team were like major headliners at one point. It's like I said, it'd be awesome if we could somehow finally get footage of these guys working, because, you know, it was a different era. But I think in a lot of ways, you know, we would still recognize like a tag match from the 50s, early 60s as being very similar to what we would get even today as a tag match. I think the structure of tag team wrestling, you know, has been very similar over the decades, and is very recognizable throughout the eras. From there, they used the U.S. tag straps in New York until 1967. They started in 1958 with them, and then they just sort of vanished for whatever reason. And then later, a couple years later, they brought in the international tag team titles.
Mm-hmm.
Which are kind of a really obscure tag team title. They only lasted a couple of years, 69 through 71, and they seem to have been used more in the Pittsburgh territory, which was owned by Bruno Sammartino for a good part of the 60s, and I think in the beginning of the 70s too. But it was technically separate from the rest of the McMahon territory from the Northeast, and like Bruno booked the territory, and a lot of wrestlers, of course, wrestled in both areas, but they had their own TV show and their own angles and feuds. And
wow.
Yeah, it was totally separate. And it seemed they had more of an emphasis on tag wrestling than the main territory did. And the Mongols were a famous team from that era and held the international tag team titles for a long stretch in that time. Bruno and Dominic DiNucci actually had a two-week run with the international tag team titles. I had to mention that, of course.
You know, right.
And it's just to throw Dom's name out. But yeah, kind of an obscure title, and it just sort of faded away too. The birth of the title that even exists today as the WWE tag team titles happened in June of 1971 with Tarzan Tyler and Crazy Luke Graham, your first tag champions, apparently winning a tournament in New Orleans against the Sheik and Dick the Bruiser in the finals, which...
I didn't know that. I did not know who they had beaten to get the titles.
And basically, as is sort of like a reoccurring thing through the history of the WWF, is their tournaments are fictitious. You know, you have the famous ones in Rio de Janeiro for the first Intercontinental title, for the first WWF title, even. And this tournament was fictitious also. The reason it was held in New Orleans is because, of course, if you're a fan in the Northeast, you wouldn't be able to verify that at all. It's like, oh, yeah, I guess it happened, sure. But you wouldn't know if it happened in New Orleans or not. The funny thing is, I think Sheik and Dick the Bruiser were actually feuding with each other in 1971.
I was going to say that I didn't sound like a tag team because I feel like Dick the Bruiser would hate the Sheik.
Yeah, and I think in 1971 was sort of the peak of their feud in Detroit and also in Indianapolis.
So Tyler and Graham were the first tag team champions, and they were managed by a man who would come to basically define the tag team division for the next 15, 16 years. Basically would be the manager of every heel side over that period of time. This man, of course, the guiding light, Captain Louis Albano. Now, Marty, recently, this week actually, you were on the debut episode of Brainbuster, and you emerged victorious.
Woo! Yes! Yes! Yes!
A big victory over the veterans, over two guys who together probably have, I think, like 2 million wrestling discs between them, and that's only a slight exaggeration. Will and Pete. A very impressive victory, Marty.
That is true. Feels good, brother, to be the king of the internet wrestling nerds.
Yes.
And I have an open challenge for anybody who wants to take me on at Brainbuster.
Well, I will be on the coming episode, the second episode. And yes, I will accept that challenge. Steven will be the other participant.
Well, I respect you, Kelly, and I know we have a lot of mutual respect for one another. It's no holds barred once you enter Brainbuster, so expect to be psyched out. I am not going to pull any punches. If I think that an insult can get you rattled, I will take that opportunity.
I respect that, and you can expect similar from myself. Yes, so building the hype to that show, the big hit of the new year, Brainbuster. On the PWO Place to Be Network, Place to Be Nation Network. And anyway, Marty, I want to see how good you really are then.
Okay. I'm loosening up right now.
Yeah, we'll test your skills here. How many tag team championship teams managed by one Captain Louis Albano can you name?
Can I name? Oh, man, I thought you were just going to ask me the number.
50, no, okay. No. This isn't no kindergarten wrestling trivia. This is man's wrestling trivia here. He managed 15 teams.
Is it 15? It's not 16?
I'm pretty sure it's 15, yeah. Anyway,
right.
How many can you name?
All right, 15. And this is his entire run.
This is the entire run, heel and face, man.
Okay. All right, the Wild Samoans. Yeah. You managed the Wild Samoans, right?
Yes.
Okay, good. All right. He managed the Head Shrinkers.
Yes.
He did. All right, the British Bulldogs.
Yes.
The oddly paired U.S. Express.
That's right.
All right, now I'm just going to start naming heel tag teams from the 70s and hope I land some. All right, the Valiants.
Yeah.
Okay. The Yukon Lumberjacks.
Nice.
The Executioners.
Yes.
The Moondogs.
Yep.
Eight.
I'm at eight. Man, only 50%. Hold on. I want to try to get to 10. I can't think of any early 70s teams. Hold on. Let me think of the 80s. Usually Blassie does four in heels. Um, All right, I'm just going to tap out. Otherwise, we're going to take the rest of the show to do this.
Epic fail.
Yeah, so you have 8. That's not bad, not bad. Of course, Tarzan, Tyler, and Crazy Luke Green.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about the first one.
That's sort of a trick there. You missed the legendary team of King Curtis, Iakea, and Baron Mikel Cicluna, the second team that he managed.
Did Dominic DiNucci beat that? Dominic DiNucci and partner beat that team for the tag team title?
No, they didn't. It was actually Sonny King and Chief J Strongbow that.
Oh, that team. I should have guessed that Strongbow was a perennial tag team champion.
Yes, he was. And DiNucci had 2 reigns, but neither came from defeating a Cicluna, which is too bad considering the ages-long rivalry between those two. Who else? You missed, both Mr. Fuji teams, Fuji and Professor Toru Tanaka and Mr. Saito. And the.
See, I was afraid that Blassie was managing those two teams.
Yeah, no, it's if you look back at it, Albano managed literally every heel tag team. I don't even think Wizard or Blassie really managed any tag teams at all.
So Blassie didn't start managing tag teams until Sheik and Volkov.
Right. That was basically his first. And that was the first non-Albano heel team to have a championship. But yeah, I know you got the Yukon Lumberjacks. That's a somewhat obscure one. You missed the Blackjacks in 1975. Yeah, so not bad, not bad. But yes, Albano, the man behind the tag teams in the 70s and early 80s. And basically, at the period we're looking at in Titans of Wrestling right now, we've seen teams like the Valiants, who actually turned out pretty good in the footage and were entertaining. That was the 3-man Valiants in the late 70s. That was Johnny Valiant, Handsome Jimmy Valiant, and Gentleman Jerry Valiant.
That's Luscious Johnny Valiant.
Yes, and Luscious Johnny Valiant. And with, at the time, Handsome Jimmy was on the sidelines, and it was Gentleman Jerry and Luscious Johnny as the actual holders of the tag team titles. And they were fun. On the other hand, we have the Samoans in 1980, who are pretty dull. They hold the belts for a very long time. They even have singles matches against Bob Backlund and Jesus. The one that we watched, Sika versus Backlund, is one of the worst matches we've seen so far on the footage. So yeah, the Samoans, they even Martel and Gurria couldn't really get a good match out of them. And Martel and Gurria, of course, they're pretty good. Rick Martel, of course, was great. And the Moondogs, the latest team on the scene, of course, already going through various members because Moondog King was run over by a car and had to be replaced by Moondog Spot. It was a tragic day in Allentown when that happened. But anyway, the Moondog's better than the Samoans, that's for sure. And
yeah,
have some pretty good matches with Martel and Gurria, actually. So that sort of formula, of course, the Albano heel team formula, continues to repeat itself all the way up to 84. I mean, he manages Adonis and Murdoch.
For some reason, I've seen Adonis and Murdoch matches, like the Sergeant Slaughter, Terry Daniels match, and the Bob Backlund, B. Brian Blair. And for some reason, the managers didn't always come out with him, I guess. So maybe
that's one thing. No, he's definitely involved with them because they have a feud with the Samoans when the Samoans turn face.
Ah, I see.
And they even have tag matches with Albano involved. But that was it. And he would have actually turned face. Albano turned face before Murdoch and Adonis's reign was over. So that's another reason why you may not think of him as their manager. But yes, that was one of his teams.
And that's, if you skip ahead to the title switch, he ends up managing the U.S. Express because that's the switchover from him, heel to babyface, and that's also during the switchover of the tag team titles.
Right.
And Vince McMahon on commentary for you only get the finish of that match, said one of the reasons why he thinks Murdoch and Adonis fell to the young up-and-coming team of the U.S. Express is because they were confused and discombobulated and confuzzled by the fact that Captain Lou, the guiding light, was no longer with them.
Hmm, yes. Yeah, I don't know if what kind of angle they did on TV where he joined the U.S. Express. They must have did something because I don't think... Yeah, they would have debuted before Albano turned face on TV. Anyway, yes, that's what happens. Adonis and Murdoch lose the tag straps at a house show in Hartford, Connecticut, in your neck of the woods, Marty.
An hour and a half away.
Yeah. Early 1985. And the U.S. Express, we'll kind of use them as I guess, the starting point here. They were a young team, fresh. And they actually teamed first in Florida, in the old Florida territory, as far back as 1983, and held the Florida U.S. tag straps while they were there. And in 1984, they briefly worked in JCP, Crockett in the Carolinas, for a couple months. And they worked against the Koloffs at that time and may have been pegged to go far. At that point, I think this was just before the Rock and Roll Express debuted in the territory. That would have been interesting, actually, if they had stayed, what would have happened with the Rock and Roll Express. Anyway, apparently, I'm assuming Wyndham was offered quite a bit of money to go to the WWF, jump ship. He brought his dad along with him, Blackjack Mulligan.
Or his brother-in-law with him, or
yeah,
brother-in-law, something like that.
Yeah, yeah, maybe not quite at this point, but eventually, Rotunda would marry into the Wyndham clan, and of course be the father of Bray Wyatt and Bo Rotundo, or Bo Dallas, as he is known now.
And I would think that would happen shortly, because I think Bray Wyatt's only a couple years older than me, so I think he was born in probably like 86 or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this team, the U.S. Express, ended up becoming a family, basically, behind the scenes. The U.S. Express quickly went over to the WWF after a brief stint in the Carolinas. So when we see them here now in early 1985, they've been a team for about 2 years. Like I said before, they're young, they're quick, they're different than, you know, the teams that came before them in a lot of ways. And they defeated, like I said, Adonis and Murdoch in Hartford early 85. That was only a couple months after they debuted in the territory, so they got the fast push. And they roll into WrestleMania, the first WrestleMania, at the end of March in Madison Square Garden.
I think they roll in a little cocky. What do you?
Yes, I think that's a good point. Going up against Iron Sheik and Nikolai Volkoff.
A couple veterans of the scene.
Exactly.
Former world champion, former world tag team champion.
Yep. Of course, Sheik, yeah, he was still, I mean, he'd had the run with the title, lost to Hogan, had the big feud with Sergeant Slaughter in 84. Nikolai Volkoff, as you mentioned, Marty, actually, in a previous incarnation of himself, as Beppo Mongol of the Mongols tag team we talked about before in the early 70s, so one half of the international tag team champions. So they have, you know, a pretty strong list of credentials behind them. They're managed by Freddie Blassie, as we mentioned. Basically, they came together in late 84 just as an offshoot of the feud, the Sheik Slaughter feud, and they stayed together after Slaughter left. And here we are. They're the number one contenders going into WrestleMania. And yes, the U.S. Express may have been a little too cocky. They'd had a lot of success, and they lost that evening, a historic show at WrestleMania. And, of course, it was by cheating. The Sheik with the cane, Blassie's cane, striking Barry Windham in the back of the head, leading to the pinfall. And so, as we look at things now, the Iron Sheik and Nikolai Volkoff are your tag team champions. And for the first match we're going to look at on the show, we have the rematch from WrestleMania between these two teams, a match that I had never seen before prior to watching it just a day ago. And yeah, this was an interesting little match. Turned out to be a hot little match. I liked it a lot. Marty, take it away on this one.
All right. So, as you know, as we said, the WrestleMania 1 match, more famous, but a lot shorter, only 5 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
So not as much action as in this match. Though I did like in this, well, I didn't like, I actually was annoyed about this, was, I can't remember, was it Gorilla and Lord Alfred, or was it just, who was it on the commentary?
I believe this was Gorilla and Lord Al.
Lord Alfred was victim-blaming Barry Windham. He was blaming his lack of experience for Iron Sheik, you know, using the cane against him. Barry Windham, he's just wrestling a match. He's not expecting a wild cane shot. Okay? That's like saying her skirt was too short and she was asking for it. Fuck you, Lord Al. You blame the heel. Don't blame the babyface for not looking for a friggin' cane when he's in a wrestling match when you should be using wrestling holds. God, 80s commentators, man.
Yeah.
Commentating, in general. Okay, so we got Iron Sheik and Nikolai Volkov versus the UX Express, Madison Square Garden. What I loved about this match, Barry Windham. I said to myself, I want Barry Windham to be the face in peril and the hot tag. If I can get both of that, if I can basically have him wrestle the entire match, we'll be doing pretty well, and they worked out a way to do just that. So we start off the match. It's a good, solid babyface shine. It never devolves into heel and peril, which is definitely something we're going to be talking about with WWF tag team matches and that heel and peril. Mike Rotunda, he gets accused sometimes of being boring, rightfully, according to me, but because we have Iron Sheik in there, a great heel, it never falls into heel and peril because we're always seeing constant movement and constant action. When Rotunda wants to go for a headlock, Iron Sheik throws in a somersault bump. He's doing his little... he's doing the prayer routine where he kind of like bows and he says he's not worthy. It's that type of cowering heel, that constant moving heel that keeps it from being a heel in peril and kind of boring me, and we're keeping it babyface shine. From there, Windham hits such a beautiful sunset flip. The sunset flip is what won him the tag team titles. So I would think the fans are keyed in that Windham sunset flip is not only beautiful but deadly.
Yeah, and it was protected as a finisher back in those days, you know. A lot of matches were won with the sunset flip.
I did not actually know that. But so because I watched the tag team title switch before this, I now felt the importance of the sunset flip. Mm-hmm. But he misses a drop kick, which leads to his, you know, face in peril spot. Volkov he's impressed me like once, but tends to be a little lumbering. I'm a bigger fan of Iron Sheik, and just in general. I mean, I already praised him earlier, but even on offense, gut wrench suplex is really good. Windham is just so fluid. Like, this entire run, if you want to understand why people say, you know, Barry Windham was the most naturally gifted pro wrestler of all time, this is the run to look at. I mean, everything he does just looks just so graceful. And his the suplex that he does on the Iron Sheik has the commentary team popping.
Mm-hmm.
So Windham is dazed. He makes the tag team. He makes the tag. It's a lukewarm tag to Mike Rotunda at best, who hits a pair of drop kicks, but he gets cut off by some double teaming. Now, if you want something done, you got to do it yourself. And that's what Barry Windham figured. Even though he just got his ass kicked, Mike Rotunda already fucking things up for the U.S. Express. Barry Windham comes in and rams Iron Sheik's head into the top of the post, and we get the Crimson Mask. Mm-hmm. Mike Rotunda acts like he was the face in peril and acts like he just got beat up for 5 to 10 minutes, and he crawls over and he makes the hot tag to Barry Windham. Wishes granted. Barry Windham unloads on the Iron Sheik. He's hitting anyone that moves, and he's attacking that cut. He hits the bulldog, but it's Katie Barr the door. There's a pair of six brawl brewing. So he spills to the outside where Windham is gnawing on the cut, and Mike Rotunda blasts Freddie Blassie.
Yeah.
They call it a count-out victory for the U.S. Express, which is an egregious miscarriage of justice. It should have been a double disqualification or a no contest. Yeah. No reason for the babyfaces to win that match. But it was still one hell of a finish. Pretty much building up to it, that was your basic fundamental tag, nothing out of the ordinary. And then Barry Windham in like the last 3 minutes just set the world on fire. And definitely raised the bar and raised this above, like, you know, the good level. I gave it 3 stars. 3 stars. Just for the finish, pretty much.
Yeah, the finish made this match. I mean, it was a good match. Otherwise, the crowd was super hot. But the finish sort of surprised me. I wasn't expecting, for one thing, I wasn't expecting blood for some reason. And I just wasn't expecting, I guess, the kind of wild brawl that we got. So yeah, I was kind of caught sleeping with this one for some reason. Shame on me. But it had a great finish. A finish that would lead to, a steel cage match maybe, or a street fight, or some sort of blow off that unfortunately didn't happen. I don't know why they didn't have like a real true, climax to this. I mean, they do have the title switch back on TV, I think about a month or so later. That is about a 3 to 5 minute match, which essentially ends the feud between the teams there. But I would have thought like another match at MSG was in order. Oh well, we got this.
Yeah.
This was nice. Wyndham looked very good, as I would have expected going into this. The Sheik looked great. And then, their partners, they were there. Rotundo, yes. Boring, yes. He, especially as like just babyface Mike Rotundo, there's nothing more boring than that. I mean, he has a few more interesting personas to come in his wrestling career, but squeaky clean Mike Rotundo is not one of them.
Yeah.
No, this was a fun little match, and I'm glad we chose this one to look at.
Right.
So from there we go now to two different teams. Actually, chronologically, oh no, sorry, I'll have to edit this. From there we go to the next month's Madison Square Garden card. And if I didn't mention it, that card or the match we just talked about was on the May 20th MSG show. And the one we are going to talk about next was on the June 21st Madison Square Garden card. And this is something a little different. It's a six-man tag team match. It involves the US Express on one side. Their partner, though, is someone, kind of comes out of nowhere if you're not familiar with this time, but it does make sense. Their partner is George the Animal Steele, newly minted babyface at this time. Had just actually, it was the month prior on the first ever Saturday Night's Main Event in a six-man tag with Steele teaming with the Sheik and Volkoff against the US Express and Ricky Steamboat. That was the match where Steele finally turned babyface. So their opponents, you would have think, coming from that would be, at least two of the three should be the Iron Sheik and Nikolai Volkoff, but they're not. We have an interesting combination on the other side here. We have Big John Studd, who in a previous life in the 70s was one of the masked executioners in 1976, former tag team champion with Killer Kowalski, the other man under the hood at that time. They're partnered up, or he's partnered with Adrian Adonis, still New York Adrian in the leather jacket. At this time, I guess he was managed by Bobby Heenan because Bobby Heenan is the third man in this team. And the reason I thought this match was interesting on paper was basically because of Heenan's involvement. And a lot of wrestling fans, of course, know him as maybe the legendary manager of all time, but he was also a great wrestler in his own right, and for years was involved in tag team matches in all kinds of territories, in St. Louis, in the AWA, even in the WWF at this time. And so he's very underrated as a tag team wrestler. And so we have this interesting matchup, six-man tag from Madison Square Garden that, is a showcase for various individuals. And we also
Was a showcase for various individuals, and one of them wasn't even in the
Yeah, exactly. We have also Captain Lou Albano. We have sort of like a whole bunch of people associated with tag teams and tag team championships involved here.
Fatality. We had the vice president of the Mean Gene Okerlund fan club.
Yes. Yeah. And there's some good-looking 80s babes at ringside in this one.
Yes, the blonde bombshell, the true highlight of this match.
Yeah, you could say that for sure. And Mean Gene never passes up an opportunity to point out a beautiful young female at ringside. God bless him.
Ogle, 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 ogle.
And So yes, and speaking of commentary teams, yes, the Gorilla Monsoon Mean Gene team is actually kind of underrated, I would say. And of the teams that they had at this time, one of my favorite combinations, actually.
Really? Oh, yeah, I mean, I guess I've never really paid too much attention. Mean Gene seems okay. I've never really heard him. He's never.
Yeah, he actually, after 85, he didn't really do too much commentary, right. For whatever reason. But I always thought he was solid. I don't know. He felt like his voice matched like the atmosphere of Madison Square Garden, if that makes sense. I don't know. At that time, the sort of rock and wrestling vibe they had going for it. Anyway, here we go. Six-man tag. Marty, break it down.
So it just so happened that there was a blind bombshell in the front row. But the true showcase was actually for the new George the Animal Steel babyface goofball character, as opposed to the wild man, maniac, vicious, cheating heel character that he had up until this point.
Mm-hmm.
Which meant, a lot of, running away from the animal, whether it was Bobby Heenan hopping over the top rope or Adrian Adonis being caught in the corner and being licked by George the Animal Steel, or the finish, which proves that nobody was safe from George the Animal Steel when he walloped the referee with a steel chair to draw the qualification. Overall, match was fine. It wasn't like any great shakes. Probably the best part, or the best part for me from a wrestling standpoint, was the Big John Studd Barry Windham interactions.
Yes.
Big John Studd, I don't think he's generally highly praised as a worker, but
nope.
I've actually found him to be pretty entertaining in watching his matches from this time period, mostly for the body slam challenge gimmick that he was having.
Mm-hmm.
It was an excellent hook to all of his matches because people really got excited at the chance that Big John Studd might be body slammed. So, when Barry, even though he had been body slammed by Andre the Giant at WrestleMania, the teases by Barry Windham got the crowd hot, and I was really excited for the prospect of Barry Windham slamming Studd.
Oh,
other
yeah.
than that, pretty much, yeah, it was just Heenan's antics, George the Animal Steel's antics. Albano meshes a lot better with Steel. It's just weird having him, manage good-looking, hot-tag Barry Windham and Mike Rotundo.
Oh, and totally.
So, and then the finish is, it's definitely different for 1985 WWF with Steel hitting the ref, but it's all to put over the fact that, he's still a wild man, nobody's safe from George the Animal Steel.
Yes, and then the referee taking that chair shot is one of my faves, Dick Kroll, who's a not shy about taking bumps, and yeah, he sold the chair shot like death here. This, like I said, an interesting mix of characters. Heenan, the great little sneaky shit getting involved, and of course, not wanting any part of the real action. Like you said, Marty, yeah, Albano with the U.S. Express just doesn't seem right at all.
Doesn't jive.
Yeah, it's I guess the reasoning was, Albano's a face now. We got to continue the tag team thing with him, but it just doesn't. Yeah, it just is not a correct mix. I'm sure, of course, Windham and Rotundo would have respected Lou and loved the guy, but they must have thought, I don't know if it does great, wonders for our image to be, led around by this goofy looking old dude. But
yeah.
Anyway, but Steel definitely him and Albano, that's a natural pairing.
Mm-hmm.
Stud, like you said about the body slam thing, that's, I mean, I hadn't seen matches with Stud around this time in quite a while before watching this, and I forgot, yeah, how over the body slam gimmick was. It's something that doesn't really get talked about much at all, but he worked that gimmick for years. I think he started it in 83. And he was still working it, up until he left in 86.
Great gimmick. It's a great hook to any match.
Yeah, totally. Because, Andre slammed him, but that's Andre. That's like,
right.
Of course Andre could slam him. He's this, the eighth wonder of the world. He's the giant. But nobody else had at this point. Even Hogan, I don't think, had slammed him.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, because I actually watched the Hogan stud matches for one of my blogs at ridingspacemountain.blogspot.com. One more time, that's ridingspacemountain.blogspot.com. Yeah. And there was a great Hogan stud match, not from Madison Square Garden, it's from the Meadowlands. I believe it's in December. It's super hot, and I'm like, oh, I want Hogan to slam this dude. I want it so bad, but I'm thinking to myself, there's no way it's going to happen, because Andre slams him at WrestleMania 1. They got to save it for Andre, but damn it, I want it. How do they get around it? I don't know. You should watch the match.
Actually, now that you mention, I have seen it, and I do remember what happens. Yes. He slams him on the outside.
Yes, he slams him on the outside. So you still get the big pop, but it didn't happen in the ring. He doesn't get the money.
Right. Yep. Yeah. No, I do remember that now. But yeah, it was still super protected. And yeah, the crowd was just ready to explode if Wyndham would have slammed him. So that was cool. Yeah, you know, this one is what it, you know, it wasn't anything special. Oh, Adrian Adonis at one point uses a DDT.
Oh, yeah.
Gorilla Monsoon calls a reverse under the arm pile driver. Now, remember, this is before, about a year before Jake Roberts entered the territory, bringing the DDT with him. So it was kind of funny to see this in that, like, who knows if, you know, I'm sure the DDT was used here and there, but it just wasn't put over as anything special. But it was funny to see Gorilla call it that, something that sounded like he just made up the name on the spot, and he may very well.
And he also made up what it hurt. He was like, the forehead, and if you do it really properly, it will hurt the nose also.
Yeah. It's funny to see how a move like that, within the right context with the right person, means so much, and when it's used in this context, it's just a transition. You know, it's nothing. It's interesting, right? How
the DDT could still get over to this day, but
yeah. So that was a neat little sort of bit of history where we get a pre Jake Roberts DDT in a match. Yeah. So yeah, a fun match with a bunch of fun characters. So now we're going to. Perhaps, and well, not even perhaps. I think definitely the highlight match we're going to be looking at today. It's a very, very, very good tag team match. It's coming from Toronto, Maple Leaf Gardens, April 21st, 1985. And this card is on the WWE Network, the entire card.
Mm-hmm.
So fans, yes, do check this out. This, of all the matches we reviewed today, this is the one, yeah, I think you have to really go out of your way to see. We have on one side the Dream Team. This is Greg the Hammer Valentine and Brutus Beefcake, and managed by Johnny Valiant and kind of managed by Jimmy Hart too. Anyway, we'll get into that shortly. And on the opposing side, we have the Babyface Dream Team, in a way, Tito Santana and Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. Now, this is, of course, in the middle of the big Greg the Hammer Valentine, Tito Santana feud that started in 1984 and was still raging hot in April of 85. So this is an interesting match because we have the Dream Team, who had just formed not too long before this, actually. And at this point, they weren't even an official team. They were still just a makeshift team. Just that got together basically to as part of the Tito Santana Greg Valentine feud, and they debuted as a team January 7th, 1985, in Hamilton, Ontario. In an auspicious debut, they lost to Tito Santana and George Wells. So yeah, not the greatest start for the soon-to-be Dream Team, and they hadn't teamed very much prior to this match. But yeah, at the time, Greg Valentine was managed by Jimmy Hart, and Beefcake was managed by Johnny Valiant. Now, Marty, this is something I never really thought of. Like, the name Dream Team was, you know, to suggest this is like the, you know, two guys getting together with different managers, sort of as the Dream Team, you know,
right.
Otherwise, yeah. They wouldn't be together.
That's what I always heard. That's the reason for the name. I hadn't heard any other reason for the name other than that.
Yeah, I maybe had heard of that, because, but it makes sense. But at some point, Hart is phased out as Valentine's manager. I'm not sure exactly.
I think it's after he loses the Intercontinental title.
Yeah, pretty much. I think immediately after.
Yeah.
And then of course Valentine and Beefcake become a full-time team.
Yeah, because right now it's more like two singles wrestlers versus two singles wrestlers than.
Yeah, exactly. And that's something we'll look at in a future episode, the next episode, in fact, of singles wrestlers teaming together. This was they weren't even officially a team. Tito and Ricky actually teamed a few times in 1985. I think they'd only teamed once before this, though, when I looked at the records. And you wouldn't know because they're sensational as a team.
Right. I'm surprised that they teamed more than this one match, and they are amazing. I mean, it's just a natural pairing. I mean, Ricky Steamboat, Jason Carroll, Tito Santana, Hot Tag. You don't even have to think about it, and you can just imagine how awesome it is. And then when you see it, it's even better.
Yeah. No, in some alternate reality, they would have been a long-term tag team because, it is a natural pairing because Santana is so great with guys like Rick Martel, and then Steamboat was great with, of course, Jay Youngblood, legendary team, and then it's just, what a awesome team they are.
Tito was great with Ivan Putski, right?
Yes, Tito was.
Titans of wrestling.
That is the one team that Tito, unfortunately, wasn't sensational with.
Oh, no!
Yeah.
He couldn't carry the Polish hammer?
No, he couldn't. He couldn't. Well, and they were saddled with the Samoans, too, so Tito was just shackled with too much baggage. He couldn't overcome that, but anyway, I digress. Here we are in Toronto for an absolutely amazing match in front of a hot crowd. Marty, explain the greatness of this one.
I would say that this is very close to the best match of the year 1985 in the WWF, at least. I think Valentine Santana, the singles match, is probably the only thing that get close to it.
Yeah, the cage in particular. I'm trying to think otherwise. PWI, of course, gave the WrestleMania 1 main event the match of the year, but that was,
a tag team match.
Yeah, a tag team match.
Respect
too
to the tag team scene.
Yeah.
I actually haven't seen the WrestleMania 1 tag team match in a while, but.
It's pretty good. The last time I watched it, I actually was surprised how fun it was.
And I remember, the finish is pretty iconic, but I don't really remember. Mr. T does a little amateur wrestling, I think, other than that.
Yeah, there's always stuff, something's going on, there's all these different people involved. It's well worth watching, and it by no means does it suck or anything. No,
okay.
Match.
All right, so let's get on to the main, the mid-show main event.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so what drives this match and what is great about this match is it's the up-tempo offense of the babyfaces who never stop moving. They're super fast-paced. It's all about overwhelming the heels against the heels, constantly undercutting them with cheating and trying to slow down the pace and trying to bring them down. Very rarely, in wrestling, we've seen David versus Goliath, arm psychology, knee psychology, veterans versus rookies. But very rarely do you actually get a cool match where the entire match is all about two competing wrestling strategies. And this match is just a pure babyface performance against a pure heel performance, and it just makes for an excellent tag team match. So the beginning of the match is just Steamboat and Santana are just on fire, and Toronto is rocking. You got Valentine and Beefcake just flopping all over the place for them. The heels can't get anything started. They're trying to break the momentum wherever possible, but you cannot deny the Dragon and Tito Santana. But Tito Santana, arch nemesis of Greg Valentine, he goes for his figure four a little too early. The figure four he learned because Greg Valentine broke his leg with that very hold. So Tito Santana learned the hold to break Greg Valentine's leg. He goes for the figure four, but it's too early. Valentine is able to push him off, and that leads to Tito Santana getting beat down by Valentine and Beefcake. Not the world's biggest Beefcake fan, but he actually really does not suck in this match. And that's really the key. As long as Beefcake doesn't suck too bad and doesn't get in the way of the great match, we're going to be okay. So, I mean, we're getting great, you know, heel work like Valentine knocking Steamboat off the apron. But then the Beefer, he gets cocky. He's goading Steamboat. And then one of my all-time favorite WWF tag spots is when the babyface, actually, I think they probably do this all over the place in the 80s. They just need to incorporate it nowadays. Is when the babyface is on his hands and knees and he just crawls past the heels.
Yeah.
He tags in Steamboat and it's breaking loose in Toronto. Steamboat has the best hot tag I've ever seen out of him. And he is just rocking and rolling. I had actually been down on mid-80s Steamboat up until seeing this match. He was really showing the fire here.
Yeah.
Steamboat grabs the sleeper hold, but Beefcake hits him with the eye rake. Then Valentine and Steamboat are going at it, but it's, again, it's that eye rake. It's the constant breaking of that momentum. You really feel like the babyfaces are way better wrestlers. But if the heels can break that momentum with cheating or stalling, they take over with their ground-and-pound offense, then you do believe that the heels are vicious enough to win. And that's the key to transition wrestling, is presenting the babyfaces as the better wrestlers, but the heels have their they can dig in their bag of tricks to overcome the babyfaces. Steamboat gets into the face and peril. This is the natural role I was talking about earlier. Steamboat in that face and peril, we're building towards the Santana hot tag. Valentine starts to warm him up for the figure four, but Steamboat knows his way around the figure four, having faced another bleach blonde who loved figure fours in previous years. And he grabs inside cradle, which is the obvious counter to the figure four, and also could lead to a victory. Sometimes it does.
Yes.
He fights out of the corner. He makes it to Tito, and here we go, baby. There's nobody better at blood feuds in the mid-80s than Tito Santana. That man hated everybody on the roster. He just had live rounds for everybody. Everybody who was a heel, he just wanted to punch their face in. We get a big, all right, we get the big flying burrito, but Beefcake saves. We got a melee. They're double-teaming Tito. Tito flies off the top onto Beefcake. Tito blocks Valentine's atomic drop, gets the stump puller. That's when you pull the leg out from underneath your opponent and applies the figure four quickly for the submission victory. And that's how a figure four should work. It's a quick submission because, damn, it hurts. And we get the babyface celebrating. Toronto's rocking and rolling. It's a great babyface performance, great heel performance. It's fundamental wrestling. It's pro wrestling 101. It gets over in 1965, 1985, 2015. It gets over in Toronto. It gets over in North Carolina. It gets over in Japan. Doesn't matter where you are. It's culturally transcendent and temporally transcendent.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, I know. I can't top that. Holy shit. That was great. Much like this match, a very appropriate.
Oh, 4.5 stars. Match of the year for WWF.
Yeah, it is a fantastic match. I mean, it's just balls to the wall action. Not a moment is wasted. Not a moment drags. The crowd is nuclear hot. Everybody's working pretty hard, even Beefcake, I would say. Valentine, great. Santana and Steamboat, oh, geez. Just amazing. Oh, one more note on them as a team. They actually teamed 12 times, or at least 12 times in 1985, but most of their matches were against Don Morocco and Mr. Fuji.
Oh, no. Oh, I was going to say, 11 times that I feel deprived of great matches until you told me who they were.
So it would be interesting to see what they could bring out of those two.
Oh, keep it untelevised.
Yeah. As far as I know, there's nothing out there. So, yeah. But anyway, yeah. And that makes sense because Steamboat was feuding with Morocco for most of the year. So that was that.
That's true. And that's probably why I was down on 1985 Steamboat when I was rewatching a lot of the single stuff, too, like a year ago.
Yeah. I seem to recall him and Valentine having a hot match at the Garden.
Yeah, no, that was pretty good. Yeah, I remember that match. Yeah, I mean, Valentine was awesome. And
the crowd, I think, thought that was going to be a title switch. That made it the atmosphere even hotter than usual because Steamboat was the new guy. And, you know, based on traditional booking, that was the fans would have noticed that probably, you know, this was where the title was going to change. I think they thought Santana had missed his chance and had, you know, it was quite a shock actually when Santana did regain the title, I think. And then I remember one match with him and Rocco as a kid I thought was good because it was, I believe, Double Juice, and it got quite violent, but it probably doesn't hold up. And they have like a judo jacket, a couple judo jackets.
I know that they have like the karate match.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, they have one.
It seems like Steamboat wasn't in the karate gimmick. He was more in the Hawaiian gimmick with the he was wearing the flower necklace.
Well, yeah, but they were like a lot of vignettes at the time had him as like a ninja almost. Like,
right. I mean, everybody needs a gimmick in 1985 WWF, and I don't begrudge them that. I just didn't know if he was already in the karate gimmick or not.
Yeah, basically he was. That was kind of how he was introduced, I believe. And it kind of fade. Well, it was inconsistently used, I would say, over the years. Anyway, yeah, too bad that most of their matches were against Don and Fuge. Anyway, yeah, this match is great. Anyway, we've said it a million times already. I only seen this once before, and it was, well, maybe no, I must have seen it more than that because it was on one of the old tapes, but seeing it just recently, it was like I'd never seen it before. It was fresh. The finish on Valentine was great because, you know, Valentine was getting the best of Tito around the horn at this time, and it was great for the fans to get like this, you know, cathartic win for Tito over his longtime rival.
Yeah, and it builds to more singles matches.
Yeah, it does, of course. Yeah, because now, you know, you can say, well, he's got a win over him.
Over the champ.
Yeah, over the champ cleanly, so he deserves more chances, and he did get them. Yeah, this is pretty much as good as it gets for tag wrestling. Like, if I had to, you know, show someone an example of like, the 101, like you said, tag team wrestling, this would be, you know, just as good as any choice as to show somebody, because it hits all the spots, and it's just really good. It you know, you see a lot of these matches and you're like, damn, I wish there was more of these teams together, or follow-ups and stuff, but I guess we can't be too greedy. We got quite a lot of stuff anyway. So going from there, we stick with the Dream Team and we bring back the US Express and we head to Philadelphia in the summer of 85, hot times in Philly, for a big tag team title match between the two of them.
We have the classic look now for the tag straps that would be the tag belts for quite a few years going forward. This was basically only maybe a month after the Dream Team became a permanent team. Valentine had only lost the IC title, I think, in early July.
So yeah, that sounds about right.
He went very quickly to his next strap. He didn't.
Which is, right, and this is like, I think this is really good booking because Valentine had Hogan in '84, actually Hogan's best match in '84, yeah, and then had the IC belt, great feud with Tito, and then moving him into the tag team. It's constant cycling. You're constantly, Valentine's bringing heat everywhere he's going, and he's maintaining his heat.
Yep, and he was definitely one of the best performers they had at this time.
I was going to bring this up at some point. Might as well bring it up here.
Yeah.
I think it's arguable that Valentine was the best worker of the 80s in the WWF. If you take the 80s as a whole from the beginning to the end, I would say he's the best. I think Tito, Santana, and Savage are the only ones who are.
Yeah, Tito and Savage. I put Slaughter in for the first half of the 80s for sure. He had so much great stuff.
Yeah, that's the thing with Slaughter and Backlund is, I mean, if you look at the whole 80s, then it gets a little, it gets tough. Because,
yeah, exactly. No, because yeah. Valentine was in 81. Yeah. He was in New York against Backlund. And
right.
Also a feud with Pedro Morales. And then he comes back and has this run with the IC and the tag. And then at the end of the 80s, yeah, he's feuding with Ronnie Garvin in a highlight feud.
Yeah,
that has really come to be like praised, you know, years after the fact. Valentine was very consistent throughout the decade. And yeah, I mean, if you mentioned that to like a more casual WWE fan, you would kind of be laughed at, I'm sure.
Right.
Because we love the guys that are kind of, even Tito, like he's I mean, you look at the footage, yeah, he was a great babyface. He had tons of great matches, but he's not someone you would consider like or a lot of people would consider one of the all-time greats for whatever reason. I mean, mostly it's because of the way their careers nosedived. And how they were treated at the end of their runs,
right?
Where they had, you know, extended years of basically meaningless sort of matches and not really having any direction. And then Tito, of course, becomes El Matador, and
Valentine's turned face, which I think could have worked. I know a lot of people think it was lame, but yeah, Valentine being turned face in like 91 was pretty much the end.
Yeah, but it did, like you said, it did work. There was a battle royal that he had as a face, where it's him and Mr. Perfect Kurt Hennig as the final two. I was on a Saturday, one of the last NBC, if not the last NBC Saturday Night's main event. Anyway, the crowd is just molten hot for babyface Greg.
Yeah, see, I think Valentine as an ass-kicking babyface would totally get over.
Yep. Well, and he's one of those guys that, you know, that were a heel for so long that you love it when they finally do turn babyface, because you were so used to hating them for so long, and then it's so cool when they finally turn years after years and years and years. You'll never have that kind of thing anymore because guys turn so often, but
right.
Valentine you know, was a
heel. Well, until Cena turns heel.
Yes, if that's even possible to even pull off, I don't know. Anyway, that's a topic for a million other podcasts. So this match is the big one, the title switch, where the Dream Team win the straps. It's lengthy. It goes nearly a half hour, I'd say, 25 minutes.
It went by pretty fast.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, it's not like it felt like it was 25 minutes.
This one I had never seen
in full until yesterday. Marty, this is one of your faves from the time. Why don't you talk about it?
All right, so we got the Dream Team against U.S. Express in Philadelphia. And what I like about the match is the beginning is the hot start. You got the Dream Team, they jump-start the match, and it feels, like, ferocious. And then you have the U.S. Express slowly overwhelm them because they are the better wrestlers because they are the babyfaces are better wrestlers, and heels have to cheat to undermine the babyfaces. Mm-hmm. So you get this is the match where you can finally see heel in peril, which is the WWF style. It's Rotundo goes to some headlocks, but what I, you know, like I've said before, with Wyndham and Stud and Wyndham and Sheik, is I really wanted to see Wyndham Valentine. You get it for 2 minutes here, but 2 minutes is not enough. I don't actually think they've ever had a singles match, or will ever have a singles match, which is a real shame. Mm-hmm. What works out pretty well here is that the transition to the heel and to the babyface in peril is done so well. Beefcake has been totally suffocated by Rotundo, and Beefcake manages to get over to his corner, tag Valentine, but in such a way that Rotundo can't see it, and then Valentine comes flying off onto Rotundo. I thought that was actually a really neat transition into the heat segment, where Valentine does a really good job, and what Valentine does so well and what makes him so different than all the other WWF competitors is just how stiff he works and just how he lays in everything, elbows, and just working over the baby faces in general. Valentine gets kicked off by Rotundo on his figure four, which is... And this is another thing that the WWF did really well, was that the hope spots built towards the climax. You didn't just have Rotundo, like, launch Valentine off on the figure four and tag Barry Windham. He actually had to hit two or three different spots before he could tag in Barry Windham, which really builds to that climax. And what's cool about this match is, in the 80s, unlike today, where we get like 8 billion false finishes, there aren't that many false finishes. So when they actually do the double noggin knocker, and Valentine puts Beefcake on top of Rotundo, and Rotundo kicks out at 2,
yeah,
it was huge. Like, yeah. Philadelphia, like, gasped. That was like, oh, they really thought that was it. Because they're used to, like, the pinfall towards the end of the match being the pinfall.
Yep.
And actually, you get another one, because Big Barry comes in, and Barry Windham is just an awesome hot tag, and then he hits the Bulldog. I mean, this is the move, and Valentine kicks out. Mm-hmm. So this, I mean, for, as a smart wrestling fan, you know that not only is this the end of US Express, Barry Windham is leaving the company.
That's what I was thinking, was that, yeah, they knew he was leaving, so they buried his finisher, basically.
Yeah, so Valentine kicks in, well, it also adds to, like, Valentine's aura that he could kick out.
Exactly, yeah.
So Windham goes for the second Bulldog. Beefcake uses Luscious Johnny Valiant's hair product, puts it in Wyndham's eyes, and what I love about this is that Wyndham is writhing in pain, Valentine hits the elbow, and Wyndham continues to writhe while in the pinning combination that moves them the title. Perfect selling by Wyndham. Once again, Barry Windham looks like a total star, even though his finisher got kicked out of. Valentine looks like a stud. And Rotunda and Beefcake just don't do any. The Rotundo Heat segment kind of dragged with a bunch of face locks. So I don't think this is as good as the Santana Steamboat match. I'd say it's about 4 stars because there was some lulls and dragging, but yeah. Overall, a very good match.
It told a pretty good story. One thing I will say about Beefcake is I do dig his swank gear, especially this yellow lightning bolt outfit that he didn't wear too often.
Are you a big fan of also of his, like, the one of the tights where you can basically see his, like, entire leg?
Yes. When I was a kid, I loved Beefcake mostly because he seemed hip to me with his hair and his neon colored tights with the tassels and rips and stuff. Like, and that was another reason I liked the Rockers a lot, was because of their attire and the neon, and also the Ultimate Warrior too. I loved
it. Ultimate Warrior is pretty cool looking.
Yeah, it was in the late 80s. That was like the height of fashion in a lot of ways. Terribly, terribly dated now. And
I still think it's awesome, but I am a huge fan of the 1980s fashion, music, and all that stuff. So
that's right.
Warrior is like the pinnacle. It's pro wrestling, heavy metal, and 80s fashion in one package.
Okay. Well, if we lived in the same city, Marty, for Halloween, we could have been the Dream Team, and you'd be Beefcake, and I'd be Valentine. maybe someday. Who knows? You never know down the road.
Yeah.
That would be cool. But yes, Beefcake's gear. That was definitely one thing that helped make him stand out from the crowd, was he had someone, I don't know who it was, but somebody putting together his outfits, because he had a ton of different combinations and variations. Anyway, yeah, this was a pretty good match. It built to the finish quite well in the hot tag. Pretty long actual, you know, where Rotunda was in peril for quite a while, and they did have the heel in peril sequence too. I mean, this had,
right, so both parts where the match dragged, Mike Rotunda.
That's true.
I don't think so.
No, it isn't. I've never tried to really defend Rotunda, other than, you know, I like Varsity Club Mike Rotunda quite a lot. I think that was his calling. That was, you know, his role.
Yeah.
That was his best role as a wrestler, was as the you know, the jock asshole.
Yeah, it's really good. That's,
yeah,
definitely,
and that was built like very well. You know, that's a great feud as far as it told such a great story. I love those kind of feuds where, you know, it's a long building thing over months and months and months. Anyway, yeah, that was Rotundo's peak as a wrestler, and or as far as like producing great matches, he's just not there. I did like IRS too at the time because I was a heel fan, a teenager, and he was definitely a guy nobody liked. Even as like a heel fan, you kind of had to go out on a limb to like IRS.
He's pretty lame.
Yeah, I like Money Inc. a lot. I was a big DiBiase fan. And
This is why you and Parv get along so well.
Yeah, maybe that's one of the things. I always envisioned, you know, when Flair was in there, that they would do a Four Horsemen with him, the Money Inc., and Shawn Michaels. Would have been like the WWF 1992 Four Horsemen.
That'd be pretty good, yeah.
Yeah, so there's a bit of fantasy booking for you. Not something I do very often. This was good. And it was Johnny V's cigar, right? That he...
Oh, it was cigar? I thought it was hair product.
No, I'm pretty sure it's the
cigar. Why did I think it was hair product?
Really? Because they didn't say what it was. Like, the announcers acted like they didn't know.
You know what? I think it probably was a cigar. I just assumed it was hair product. It makes more sense for it to be a cigar.
I could have swore when I saw this match, the finish of it, that they actually, the cigar was left in the ring and the camera focused on it at one point, but I could be remembering.
That sounds right. I might have
We didn't see that, but they did kind of cut it off early in this one. So maybe on the Coliseum home video, they had a bit longer sequence. Anyway, the finish was good. And like you said, yeah, Wyndham struggling with the kick. I really sold the eye injury well. Where I, you know, when I was a kid seeing this, it was things like that that I really almost kind of disturbed me. It was like, oh, he must have really, you know, he was really hurt. I'm Rick Martel. In 1981, he'll take a handful of salt in the eyes, and that was a real traumatic moment for me as a kid, because Martel sells that salt in the eyes like, oh, it's so realistically. But yeah, this was a pretty good match. I'm glad I finally got to see it in full. The crowd was pretty pissed off at the end that the heels won. I wonder if Johnny was at this match. He went to a lot of shows at the Spectrum back in the day. I wonder if this was one that he went to, actually. I'll have to ask him
next
time I talk to him. But yeah, so we have new tag champs. We have the Dream Team going forward here. And our next match, we're going back to MSG. And it's they teamed a bit. I can recall them on TV a few times. As a kid, we have Tito Santana and Pedro Morales challenging the Dream Team. And I wonder if this is like the absolute latest, like the Santana Valentine feud went, you know, I guess you could say it was completely over by this point, but they kind of dragged it back. And I guess they would sort of tease it a few times over the years.
He
never let it go.
There was a great Tito Santana, Greg Valentine match from 1987 or 88. It's 88. Yeah. I think it's probably the best match that happened in the WWF in 1988.
Yeah, I remember you writing about that one too, and I have never got around to it. That's another one I got to check out. But again, you know, Tito would always, you know, of course, with Martel after the Strikeforce split up, they would always have confrontations and Royal Rumbles and stuff, you know, long after their feud was supposedly done. So Santana and Morales, this is definitely a New York City attraction with Pedro in the match. At this point, Pedro was very close to being just an outright, well, he was a jobber to the stars. I guess it wouldn't be fair to say he was close to being an outright jobber. But,
and you know your jobbers, Kelly.
And I know my jobbers. Outside of New York, maybe Boston, I think he was still used. He wasn't really featured very much by this point. But him and Santana did team a little bit. So we have this match. It's pretty obscure. I'd never seen it before. A few months after the Dream Team have won the titles. It's November 1985. And Marty, what are your thoughts on this one?
Well, I had brought up before that my family is a big fan of the Strongbow. My dad, because of his age, his peak wrestling fan watching actually coincided with the Morales reign, not the Bruno reign. So he is not, he doesn't really care about Bruno. He is a Pedro Morales fan. So, want to bring that up.
Yeah, we've watched a lot of him on Titans, and he's really settled into sort of this, he's not doing too much in matches. You could call him lazy. He's had some good ones, but the last few Pedro matches we've watched have been pretty dull. Anyway.
Okay. All right. Well, my dad was watching him in like 72,
Yes. He probably was a house of fire then.
I'm sure he was. Well, there was glimmers of it.
Yes.
So the thing that I love about Greg Valentine is because he takes all WWF wrestlers out of their comfort zone because of the way he goes about matches, how he uses strikes a lot. So many WWF matches, and this is true to this day, are about spots and iconic moments and like getting that over. And Valentine is the one who gives it a sense of struggle. There's a sense of, I want to win this match, and I'm going to win this match through bulldozing you over. So Valentine and Morales start off with actually a pretty heated exchange of body shots. Like, it was intense, and Pedro ends up winning that one with his left hand. And Valentine's really good at also not always being the tough guy. He's willing to stooge, and he's got, of course, the timber bump where, so Valentine and Santana tease their figure fours early after Pedro gets out of it, and the garden is rocking for Tito. You know, big Tito chance. And I always love Tito opening up with rights on Valentine. Mm-hmm. So Valentine tags out. The story remains the same for the Beefcake Man. Valentine is outside hugging Johnny V. There needs to be more heels that hug. Team Hell No getting the hug over as a babyface act. Boo! Heels that hug. That's what we want in this world. Yeah. I think Beefcake ends up going out there. We get a little heel and peril arm work on Beefcake. So once again, this is the WWF style where the babyfaces take the majority of the match. And because they're taking so much of the match, sometimes they have to rely on these holds that kind of drag down the match. Mm-hmm. This really interesting chicken confrontation, though, that comes out of this. So Morales has Beefcake in the chicken wing. He's going for the half Nelson for a pinning combination. Valentine and Santana are both in the ring, and there's like this game of chicken going on, and Valentine beats Santana to the punch and actually breaks it up. And then in like the best moment, I think, in a long time that I've seen, was Valentine, instead of just cheating, just absolutely obliterates Pedro's face with stiff right elbows. Like, Valentine could have wrestled in Japan. He could have wrestled right now in 2014 against guys like Cesaro and Sheamus. The dude was awesome. Yeah. And so, I think Pedro ends up tumbling outside the middle rope at some point.
Yeah, he takes a pretty big bump.
A pretty big bump for Pedro, because up until that point, Pedro wasn't moving too well.
No.
So I was pretty surprised Pedro took the bump to the outside. So we got Beefcake in. He hits the sleeper. This is apparently the first time that Beefcake applied the sleeper. So this is a historic match for Watson. Historic match on Titans Extra.
Yes.
The first time Beefcake applied his patented sleeper hold. No scissors yet.
Of his baby face turn, I guess you could say.
Beefcake goes for the spinning toe hold. Beefcake is just a wrestling submission master in this match. And this is what I'm talking about. This is the one thing I really like about the WWF. When Pedro kicks out, once again, it's not the immediate tag to Tito. Beefcake wrestles like an intelligent human being, tags in Valentine almost immediately, and Valentine pounces on Pedro. So then you get that sense of struggle where that, you know, Pedro still has more to overcome. Valentine goes to the figure four now, but Pedro has one last burst of energy, and now he's making the tag to Tito. Tito is such a great pissed-off House of Fire. He is the man. He wrestles every match like it's a blood feud, but it's even better when it's against Valentine.
Yeah.
He puts the figure four, but then Valentine deliberately attacks Tito while in the figure four, triggering the disqualification. It's the 1980s. You're going to get a pretty lame finish.
Yeah.
Overall, that was a pretty good match. I gave it 3.5 stars, and I thought, for Pedro being old, took some bumps. Valentine is awesome with his right elbow,
mm-hmm.
and he's the man.
Yeah, I like this one, too. Super heated with a hot finish. You know, it could have been a great finish in the sense if they did, you know, go on with these two teams and had a rematch. But I believe this was one and done, unfortunately, because, it got heated. Morales is the perfect spot for him now in 1985 to be in tags. And Santana, geez, I mean, he can tag with just about anybody. You know, he really is, when you look at it, a great tag wrestler, as much as he's a great singles wrestler. I mean, Tito could do it all. It was a good match, good crowd, And Beefcake again, you know, held his own, wasn't a detriment. Valentine has been pretty much the story of the show, I think, so far.
He's just going to hit you straight in the mouth. You can't argue against that.
Yep. Yeah, no, you're right. He had like a unique style that, you know, he stuck with, and it worked so well, and it was, you know, a very hard-hitting style.
It's really different in the WWF. Like, it really stands out because he's the only one really doing it.
That's true. You know, and this is an interesting time. I love this era because you had guys coming from all the different territories and who had, you know, learned different things and worked different styles, and they were all meshing together. And the style, even then, I think, you know, the WWF was going for like a house style. And you know, it would become pretty rigid. But at this time, you know, it was still a little wild, and you had different styles clashing.
Yeah, it really felt like an all-star type of thing.
Yeah, it is. Like the 84, 85 years really feel like, like an all-star promotion. And there's a lot of interesting stuff going on and a lot of interesting personalities. So it's a cool time. But yeah, this was good. I was a little worried with Pedro being involved, but, you know, it's a tag match. If it was a singles match from this time, with Pedro against, maybe Valentine probably could have got something.
I think Valentine could have got enough out of him. I've really never seen a bad Valentine match, and I've seen a lot of them from this period.
No, that's a good good point. I can't say I've...
You know what? I actually have seen, there's one, one boring Valentine match is the, there's a couple. There's the Beefcake matches are pretty boring. And the worst match is the only person that can actually drag Valentine into the bad territory is Don friggin' Morocco. What a snooze fest.
Especially if that's like 1987 or 88.
Yeah, babyface Don Morocco with superstar Billy Graham as his manager.
That's very bad. Morocco was so juiced at that point he could barely move. And
oh god, it was bad. I mean, I couldn't believe that I was watching a bad Valentine match.
Was that a WrestleMania 4 tournament match, or am I thinking of... No, it wasn't.
No, it wasn't, because he fought... Oh, that was the one thing, and we'll probably get to at one point. I actually like Dino Bravo over Bruce Beefcake as Valentine's partner. Valentine had better matches with Beefcake, but I think it's a better team.
Interesting. Yeah, that'll be an interesting thing to look at, because that's the second Dream Team is nearly not remembered near as much as the original Dream Team.
I think the original Dream Team is pretty under the radar, too.
Yes, in the grand scheme of things, that's true, too. Because they kind of were on the fringe of the big explosion when the Bulldogs take over, and then the Hearts and Demolition and all those teams take over. So, but yeah, that's true. So we'll be
The classic stuff is always the Hart Foundation, Bulldogs, Demolition, those people.
Yeah, that's the one you'll always go to as far as like the big names. But as we'll see, there's a lot under the surface that needs to be looked at and explored. This match is kind of a perfect example of that, because you would never think, you know, to look at this, or most wrestling fans, I doubt, would ever give this a second glance. But it's good. The Garden, of course, you know, perfect setting for a match like this too, with Pedro's past in New York. And Tito was huge in New York.
Tito was over like Rova.
Yeah, super over. So now we'll go on to our final contest for the day. And fittingly, it's kind of an unusual matchup, a unique matchup that sort of ties everything together. We started with Sheik and Volkov, and now we'll end with Sheik and Volkov in a rare heel versus heel match.
Mm-hmm.
I believe this was just filmed for a tape release. It was from a TV taping. It's from Poughkeepsie, New York, where they taped Championship Wrestling at the time. But I'm pretty sure it didn't appear on the actual weekly show. And the commentary is Monsoon, clearly post-produced, dubbed commentary over this match, not live commentary. So I think it was something maybe they would put some of these like bonus matches or feature matches on the early tapes as sort of an incentive to buy something that you hadn't seen before. So I'm thinking that was kind of the reasoning behind this, because as far as I know, there was no angle between the two teams. There was nothing going on in the regular continuity of WWF at that time that would match these two teams together.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting because we have now the Dream Team as baby faces.
Yep, de facto baby faces.
Yeah, I mean, and pure baby faces. It wasn't even really a match of... It was a match of heels on paper, but as far as the action in the ring...
This is true. There was a... That was one of the things that came with it. There was a lack of cheating.
Yes, there's... Yeah, it wasn't a match of heels in the ring. It was... The Dream Team are clearly the baby faces in this match, and they act totally like a baby face team. Which is interesting. So this is a neat little match. I mean, it's not very long. It's a quickie, but it's interesting for various reasons. So Marty, let's take it away on this last one.
All right. So the big takeaway from this, I want to see Greg Valentine versus Iron Sheik in a singles match.
Yeah.
I want to see that match. That's great. That's a great match. Greg Valentine, ass kicker. You got Iron Sheik. He cowers in the beginning, but he knows how to be vicious in the middle. Then you got a finish of some sort. I want to see that match. Book it, Vince.
Mm-hmm.
As for the actual match that we got, yeah, like I said earlier, the Dream Team plays the de facto baby faces. We get Beefcake falling prey to Volkov's headlock. Beefcake's punches look worse when you they're viewed next to Valentine's, but, you know, it's true for basically anybody. Valentine and Sheik finally square off. Sheik busts out the dropkick for the timber bop in the for the spot of the match, in my opinion, was the Sheik dropkick. Sheik's got his gut wrench suplex, which is one of my favorite moves. I just generally like the gut wrench suplex,
Sheik
does a good job with it. He applies the camel clutch, but the hammer saves the beefer. Valentine looks. Do they call him the beefer? I think somebody calls him the beefer, right? Gorilla does, or something.
That's one of his nicknames.
The beefer. Valentine looking for that figure four, but then the world's weakest Donnybrook breaks out. Double disqualification. Yeah, it was pretty weak showing on that double disqualification. I've seen a lot better than that.
Yeah, no, this one didn't have a good finish. I mean, it was worked at a pretty brisk pace, actually. You know, it wasn't slow. There was constant motion. Everybody was always doing something and switching and all that. But yeah, it didn't end very well. But it was interesting. I was I was expecting a heel versus heel match, so I was momentarily surprised when. You know, the Dream Team just totally went babyface, and Brutus in particular was like, I guess as he was auditioning for a future babyface role with this, with playing to the crowd. And even Valentine totally changed his style in a lot of ways just for this match.
Mm-hmm.
And he, as far as I know, he didn't have too many prior face runs. I know he had one at the very end of his stint in the Carolinas in 84 before he went to the WWF. He had a couple month, 2 or 3 month run as a babyface at the very end there. But other than that, prior to this, not much that I know of. But yeah, he basically was able to switch to the babyface role with ease. But yeah, this could have been more. But it was, you know, it was what it was. It was something they just slapped together one Saturday or whenever they... filmed this, and I don't think it meant much in the grand scheme of things. So that's it for today. We looked at a varied collection of matches and focused on three particular teams, and I'm interested going forward. Like was hinted, next time we're going to stay in 1985, but we're going to look at, you know, the thrown together makeshift tag teams, the two, you know, main event baby faces versus two main event heel teams. There's a lot of interesting stuff with Roddy Piper, Bruno Sammartino, Paul Orndorff, Andre the Giant. So we'll have some big names. We'll see how it goes. We may, I guess we'll have to introduce, I believe, the Hart Foundation and the British Bulldogs next time, because that starts in 1985. And yeah, and then we're going to move forward from there. There's a lot of, you know, stuff to look at, a lot of interesting stuff, and stuff that I've never seen. Stuff that I'm not even aware of. We're gonna dig up some stuff. Who knows?
I'm sure I'm just gonna be hitting Control F on the history of the WWE.com, and we'll find some stuff.
Yeah, because we did have a pretty extensive list of stuff that sort of made the cutting room floor for this show that could have been interesting. I think we'll have to look at stuff from the Boston Garden, for example.
Of course, parquet floor.
A lot of footage there. Of big time matches.
The real garden.
Yeah, the garden. We got lots to look at, and yeah, I had fun today, Marty. It's always a pleasure.
It was a ton of pleasure talking about one of my favorite wrestlers of all time, Greg the Hammer Valentine.
Yes, we praised Valentine, we praised Santana quite heavily.
That's true.
Yep, it was interesting to look at the US Express, because outside of, you know, a smattering of matches, I'd never really seen a lot of them before. Even the Sheik and Volkov, you know, I'd forgotten that in, you know, in 1985, Iron Sheik could still go.
There's actually like a decent Sheik Volkov Bulldogs match, I think, too.
Yes, I know I've seen at least one or two of those matches over the years. And I mean, they keep going into 1987 as a team.
That's true, yeah.
They still have a lot ahead of them.
The Bolsheviks. Now that was a bad team.
Yeah, we'll see. But I mean, I want to, you know, no, we're not going to leave any stone unturned.
I've seen some Bolshevik matches.
We're going to have to do some Bolsheviks. We're going to have to do some rhythm and blues.
I haven't seen any rhythm and blues. It is hard to find rhythm and blues matches. I went out of my way to try to find the Hart Foundation versus rhythm and blues, and I could not find it.
Hmm. Well, we'll see what we can do. I mean, at least Hammer's in that team. I mean, albeit with jet black hair, which at the time was kind of like a sad turn for him. But we'll see. Yeah. Maybe there's some gems.
Yeah, I have a lot to say about the Hart Foundation at some point. But the Hart Foundation's main feud in late 1990 was with Rhythm and Blues. So
that's right.
It's hard to find Rhythm and Blues matches.
Hmm. Well, we'll see what we can find. Also, in coming episodes, maybe in the next episode, we'll get in depth with the WWF tag team structure in comparison to other areas.
Yeah.
We touched on it a bit with the heel in peril, which is kind of known to be like a unique trope for WWF tag wrestling. And we kind of ran out of time today, but next time we'll have an extended look at WWF in comparison to the southern areas, to the AWA, to Japan even, and there's a lot to discuss there. So yes, look for it. It'll be every, you know, few weeks, you know, we'll see. At this point, it's kind of up in the air, but definitely going forward, Marty and I will be exploring the 80s WWF tag teams. Enjoy.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yep. Goodbye.
Read all about it. Extra, extra, read all about it. Extra, extra, read all about it.